Arsenal for Democracy is freely available weekly at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple and Stitcher, and we're supported by some listeners at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy for $3 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stuntbird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, New York Island, the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 396, recorded on Sunday, September 19th, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
Arsenal for Democracy this week begins a mini-series on money in the 19th century United States. What was it, tangibly and intangibly? Was it something physical with a real value, or more of a unit of account on ledgers somewhere? How did people understand it at the time versus how we understand money today in the third decade of the 21st century? How did that understanding shape the way people used money? Or perhaps did people's uses of money shape their understanding of it? What were the economic, political, and socio-cultural implications of the 19th century version of American money? To prepare for this mini-series, Rachel and I read a lot of books this summer. Some of them were directly dealing with this subject from various angles, while others were only tangentially related, or were intended to get us thinking way outside the box on the philosophical, existential questions around money in the past and present. Some of the books were good, some of them weren't very good, and we'll give our thoughts as we kind of go along on them as we proceed through this mini-series. All of them, certainly we got something out of them, though. The six books that we read, that some combination of us read, were Debt, The First 5,000 Years by the late David Graeber, the anarchist economic anthropologist, published in 2011. Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution, 1863 to 1877, by Eric Foner, the American political historian, published in 1988. Financing the American Dream, A Cultural History of Consumer Credit, by Lendahl Calder, published in 1999. The Rise and Fall of American Growth, by Robert J. Gordon, published in 2016, which we've already used in several episodes this summer. Inflated, How Money and Debt Built the American Dream, by R. Christopher Whalen, published in 2011. And The Verge, Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World by Patrick Wyman, published in July 2021. As you can tell from the titles, some of these books very specifically cover the Second Industrial Revolution period that we've been focusing on for the past year and a half on Arsenal for Democracy. A couple are broader examinations of American economic history, not exclusively focusing on that period, and a couple of them get much deeper into the emergence of European proto-capitalist finance four centuries before our story, as well as the theoretical underpinnings of money as a concept going back to the misty human past. We also drew on some money-specific episodes of Mike Duncan's Revolutions podcast, where he happened to mention some financial infrastructure or coinage and monetary policies that were relevant as points of contrast to the situation in the United States. Obviously, we're not going to be quite as broad in our examination of the topic as some of these sources were, but we thought that it was important to get deep into the fundamentals, the theory, and the philosophy to have a meaningful and enriched discussion on late 19th century American money. Before we jump into this first episode, we want to give a summary overview of where we're going with this, so you can contextualize each part of the series, which isn't necessarily going to correspond with episode numbering, and think ahead as we move through the history. We're going to talk first a bit about money in the antebellum United States before the American Civil War of 1861 to 65, so you can see the revolution in American money unfold more clearly. Then we'll talk about money during the Civil War and its immediate aftermath during Reconstruction, when physical money and virtual money evolved temporarily from the pre-war situation. Next, we'll look at how money functioned in people's daily lives as a practical matter after the Civil War, even when, or especially when, they didn't have much access to it physically, but still needed to conduct economic activity. Then we'll try to provide better context for the dramatic national political battles over hard cash that you might have heard about in school, like the Cross of Gold speech, but perhaps didn't totally understand, in part because from a modern vantage point, there's a case to be made that a lot of the people at the time also didn't really grasp what they were battling over on both sides, even when they thought they understood the debate and its implications. Finally, we'll have a series epilogue on the explosive emergence of things like consumer credit, auto loans, and home mortgages as the 19th century gave way to the 20th century. We'll probably return to those subtopics in more depth in future episodes outside of this series, but in this series we'll be examining them as the kind of bookend of the processes and transformations that we've been talking about, rather than as a launch pad for everything that followed. So as I said, it's basically a series in five parts, but we're going to not necessarily have one episode per part. It'll depend on how we go in terms of the content. And we're going to start off with part one right now, antebellum money. So with that series overview out of the way, let's get into the status quo situation of money in the pre-Civil War period of U.S. economic history before any of the emergency measures of the war kicked in. The situation on that front was, of course, far from static as well in the period from the American Revolution through 1860. Government policies had changed a great deal, often back and forth fairly dramatically, and most critically, the end of the period had seen the twin arrival of railroad and telegraph lines all over the United States. One of the defining features of the United States economy before these two things came to prominence was how slowly materials, finished goods, money, and information traveled to and from the interior, most especially in the regions without easy navigable river access. Granted, much of world history as a whole has featured a kind of seesawing between better and worse infrastructure and thus travel speeds. But as we've talked about in so many past episodes, nothing in past global history came close to the explosive gains in speed from developments like ocean-going steamships, river steamboats, steam railroads, and telegraphy, particularly as each of these technologies continued to improve year over year with new propellers, better boilers, better wiring, and so on. But let's jump back in time using the books by Graeber and Wyman. Several centuries earlier, early modern Europeans, nearly 1,000 years after the fall of the Western Roman Empire, and the collapse of its physical infrastructure and classical taxation systems, had managed to come up with various workarounds for the incredibly slow speeds for moving cargo and physically heavy precious metals for money around the mountainous and forested interiors of Western Europe. Generally, these involved setting up reliable, trustworthy networks of bankers and/or money changers around the region, from Italy to the English Channel, from Iberia to Germany, and so on. This had the benefit of allowing someone to carry pieces of paper around instead of coins or ingots, and simply make necessary withdrawals or payments upon arrival. As long as the money was circulating within a particular city's mercantile community for a bunch of transactions, then there was no need to carry physical money long distances between cities, since someone else would inevitably then have to bring back its equivalent later. These type of paper-based credit arrangements were crucial in the late Middle Ages during a literal shortage of precious metals in Europe, because the money was flowing out of Europe to India and China to buy luxury goods faster than it was being mined. That's at least true up until the late 15th century, when there was an innovation in production of precious metals for coins, and also, of course, the exploitation of colonialism in Africa and the Americas shortly thereafter. These early modern European merchants and financiers also initially had a transnational common financial infrastructure in the form of the Catholic Church prior to the Protestant Reformation. And in fact, as Mike Duncan noted in one of his Revolutions podcast series, the Spanish imperial authorities managed to deploy this convenient apparatus right up until the early 19th century in some of their American colonies by outsourcing some depository banking and land mortgage lending functions to the Catholic Church in the Americas, which was accessible anywhere and everywhere in the empire to make those transfers of money in the records. Obviously, this was not available in the United States as an option, since it was not a Catholic country. Indeed, this absence of a common banking infrastructure was one of the defining features of the United States in this period. When combined with the truly American spirit of constant cons, scams, and ripoffs, and the rugged individualism of refusing to let the government enforce any kind of standards and trustworthiness, this lack of banking infrastructure meant that the United States somehow managed to simultaneously lack the reliable financial networks of 1400s Europe that facilitated trade and investment across sovereign jurisdictions, but also that everyone was constantly getting completely owned by financial panics and busts based on nothing but a shockingly excessive amount of financial instruments floating around based on nothing. The United States entered a constant cycle of excessive and unreliable liquidity versus extreme credit crunches, At several points, the government was letting everyone basically issue their own money instruments on paper, which would then become worthless. Not so much because there was too much issued, or even because it was paper money, but rather because there was no bank clearinghouse process even locally, let alone nationally, until the 1840s, according to Whalen. And without that, there was no trust that these paper instruments would ever be redeemable anywhere, privately or publicly, at face value, which led to immediate discounting from face value. Now, Rachel, there's a paragraph from the Whalen book that kind of illustrates the situation here at the time.
In the early 1800s, paper money issued by private, state-chartered banks generally traded at a steep discount to the face value when converted into precious metal, especially when it was issued by banks outside of the state or local market where it was presented for payment. The notes used at that time generally promised to pay the bearer of the note a certain amount of physical gold or silver upon demand. The experience of banks failing was all too common for Americans in that period. There was a deep suspicion in the marketplace when a note from a faraway state-chartered bank was presented for payment. This was one reason that payments by and to state and federal agencies were done only in metal coins, not paper, and most contracts of the day likewise specified metal as the consideration. In the 1840s, there was no clearinghouse for banks to use to validate the authenticity of paper money issued by private banks.
At other times, when the government wasn't allowing a free-for-all, the federal government, or more likely the state governments, would sometimes crack down so hard on the privately issued money or quasi-money that they would functionally end up extinguishing credit, transactional payment methods, things like that, and the economy would ground to a halt completely. This brings us to a key point that we have to make throughout this series. Money in the United States in the 19th century included both hard currency minted from precious metals and any forms of imaginary or virtual money that existed in an array of public and private credit arrangements and de facto paper money issued by private banks and corporations chartered by the various state governments. So when we're thinking about money here throughout this series, you need to be thinking in several terms, not just in the sense of coinage and not just in the sense of the official sovereign paper money that we're going to be talking about later issued by the federal government eventually, but also these various forms of privately circulated pieces of paper that could be used in certain contexts and not necessarily at face value as money for the purposes of certain transactions, especially in the private sector. So there's another section from the Whalen book that helps understand the situation in these boom and bust liquidity and crunch cycles.
Though the founders had made provision under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution for trade between the states free of tariff, there was no provision for a common currency or banking system tying the nation or even individual states together. To provide some liquidity, state-chartered banks issued various forms of notes to the public in return for some future promise to pay in hard money, that is, gold. There was no common means of exchange, nor any backstop for banks, which from time to time needed emergency infusions of funds. Panics occurred when public unease about particular financial institutions, companies, or the markets caused deposit runs on individual institutions.
Overall, there was never enough of this money, hard or on paper, to go around to perform basic economic activity. The government mints never churned out enough metal coinage because, after all, it costs some amount of money to mine and smelt the ore and to mint it into coins, which limits how low a face value can be assigned to a given coin, even without factoring in the supply and demand pressures for the metal ore itself. And even with protective import tariffs, hard metal money was physically leaving the United States by the shipload to pay off foreign debts and buy luxury goods. Paper financial instruments, whether they were some kind of stock certificate from a corporation or a bank transfer note, were ultimately meant to be redeemed against some kind of hard metal currency. And these financial agents were supposed to have physical reserves on hand to pay off these papers in circulation. So unless they were flat out scamming people, which also often happened, there were some natural limitations to how much availability of even paper financial instruments and pseudo money or quasi money that there was on hand as well. It's important to note, of course, that a great deal of economic activity can be conducted too just by moving paper certificates around a community back and forth. So there's not actually a one-to-one relationship between the paper value of money in circulation and the reserves of hard coin payment they represent, but there is still eventually a limit at the end of the line. Financial panics, as noted in the earlier quote that Rachel read, tended to cause people to suddenly reach the end of that line and attempt to cash in these instruments all at once. This would effectively crunch the money in circulation back down to the physical reserves, rather than allowing for virtual activity to happen. And the other, even more common end of the line on a paper money credit transaction chain was the federal government's steadfast refusal to accept tax payments and other revenues in anything other than the very coins it was minting and circulating in insufficient volumes for people to make payments. Again, the defining feature of the antebellum era U.S. economy is simply that there was not enough money going around, whether it's physical or imaginary or paper or something in between. Some of this could have been alleviated with more sophisticated federal financial regimes and more trustworthy credit, but some of it was just the physical material realities of life in the United States at the time. Banking across state lines was pretty unusual, and indeed some states were sometimes so fed up with the financial sector shenanigans and scams that they simply refused to charter any banks within their borders at all. Low levels of interstate commerce heavily reflected the poor state of transportation and communication networks. Economic activity tended to orient toward and flow along the ocean and Great Lakes coastlines, navigable rivers, and what few major roads existed. Until the railroads became a serious reliable factor, there were large swaths of the United States where there was not much reason for an eastern urban financial institution to be making purchases, investments, or loans outside of their own core area and across state lines. We've talked previously about this being the big reason why interstate commerce was such a small portion of U.S. economic activity for so long. It's also critical here to remember that the United States in this era was fundamentally an agrarian economy, not an industrial economy, and that the industry that did exist in the antebellum period tended to cluster in places with decent transportation and communication networks linked closely or quickly to financial institutions. If you lived basically anywhere else, time was the enemy of money circulation. If you grew crops only in one season, or perhaps two if you were lucky, then there were going to be long stretches of time during the year when you needed money you didn't have on hand to buy equipment and seeds, or hire, or in the case of slave labor, purchase labor, or you suddenly had a bunch of money from harvest and suddenly needed to pay back everyone from the other part of the year when you didn't have money. If your harvest failed for some reason, another whole year would go by before you actually saw some money. In a previous episode, we talked about the emergence of Southern agricultural capitalism for the massive forced labor plantations growing cash crops in a way that increasingly became industrialized and heavily capitalized. But for the rest of the American agricultural economy, big money capitalists were not flocking in this period before the Civil War to help farmers or farmhands see some money to rub together between harvest windfalls. As we'll dive into further on a coming episode in this series, specifically focusing on the credit economy and shadow lending, people in farm country experienced money primarily as a virtual phenomenon on somebody's ledger. They were purchasing equipment, seeds, and consumer goods like textiles or books or anything else on credit from local stores. And those local stores would never see any repayment for seasons at a time, if not years at a time. Now, they compensated for this problem, these long stretches without hard currency settlement of accounts, by raising their prices and by themselves acquiring their supplies, dry goods, and consumables on high interest credit arrangements with faraway urban manufacturing companies and financial institutions. Mostly, of course, people just tried to make do without as much as possible before the economic and cultural transformations of the late 19th century that we'll get into on upcoming episodes of this series. And so as you can imagine, that had a pretty big damper effect on the potential demand side of a consumption-driven economy. There simply was not enough money in circulation in the rural United States to support a higher level of demand-driven economic activity. What little hard currency money was paid out at harvest time would shuttle around paying off debts within the community and then ultimately flow back out of the countryside to the cities as vendors paid back their own creditors and so on. Or it was all conducted with the exchange of paper money instruments anyway, and maybe none of the coins ever made it out that far into the countryside to begin with. As railroads and telegraphs began proliferating more widely to the interior of the United States, it certainly became easier to communicate about economic needs and demands quickly. And it was much cheaper and faster to move goods in and out. But in the immediate period before the Civil War, the country was still experiencing the very long hangover of the Panic of 1837, which had dried up the amount of privately backed virtual money in circulation for a while and left all kinds of devastating debts from banks and corporations that collapsed and obliterated people's money with them. It had also left just about everyone in a much more cautious, conservative frame of mind about the nature of money or how to circulate it or regulate it. Prior to the Panic of 1837, the federal government had tended not to invest much in infrastructure. So the reality was that states and municipalities had to borrow huge amounts of money from the private sector, regardless of reliability. Those banks, in turn, were capitalized by foreign investment, which fled after the crash. The post-1837 credit crunch really slowed down economic development of the interior United States for many years, and many legislatures chose to repeatedly bail out but not significantly reform banks that they had a close relationship with for public financing. The reputation of paper within the world of American money was getting darker and darker for the population, and this created a powerful national culture of hostility toward paper money of any kind, even official government paper money that was eventually introduced during the Civil War, nearly a generation after the 1837 crash. The economy shrank and employment fell as people attempted to only engage in coin-based transactions for a long while after 1837. But unfortunately for the skeptical public, desperate for metal money to do business with each other, unregulated paper money actually continued to grow, and there was nothing to be done except to use it or hope you could get your hands on some foreign banks' paper money that had more credibility. By 1860, two-thirds of all dollars in circulation in the United States were paper instruments of some kind or another, again, despite that cultural resistance to it. And all of these paper dollars were at least allegedly redeemable for precious metals, while just one-third of the dollars circulating at the time, in 1860, were actual metal specie, aka coins. And that's according to the Whalen book. In fact, this era from 1837 until the Civil War was the so-called free banking era, in which hundreds and hundreds of wildcat banks were chartered with virtually no federal oversight and minimal state regulation. Most went bust within a few years, and yet they continued to be chartered willy-nilly all the way until the start of the Civil War. Each of these banks would attempt to issue paper money, or to use the more descriptive British term, banknotes, and they would try to circulate these banknotes with usually very poor reception. Whalen then cites the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco's modern analysis of that situation.
State banknotes of various sizes, shapes, and designs were in circulation. Some of them were relatively safe and exchanged for par value, and others were relatively worthless as speculators and counterfeiters flourished. By 1860, an estimated 8,000 different state banks were circulating wildcat or broken banknotes in denominations from half a cent to $20,000. The nickname wildcat referred to banks in mountainous and other remote regions that were said to be more accessible to wildcats than customers, making it difficult for people to redeem these notes. The broken banknotes took their name from the frequency with which some of the banks failed or went broke.
Eventually, over the course of the 1840s and 1850s, banks started setting up voluntary associations with each other, at least on a local basis, to validate and clear each other's transactions. But again, this would not be possible on a larger geographical scale until telegraphs were reliably extended deeper across the country. And even then, not every bank or financial institution participated, because all of this was voluntary, not government mandated, according to Whalen. He notes that private banks, as depicted in the climax of It's a Wonderful Life even a century later, had a ruthless habit of reacting to a momentary liquidity crisis in a competing bank by simply letting them collapse instead of helping them out. So that brings us to the end of our narrative about the antebellum money, and we'll be continuing from here into the Civil War situation. But before we get to that, I think it's important that Rachel and I take a pause here and ask some of these sort of philosophical and existential questions, many of which are addressed in, or at least raised in and speculated upon in David Graeber's book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years. So as we think about what we've just heard regarding the antebellum money situation, before we move on through the rest of this series, here are some questions that I want us to think about. How does this change our understanding of what is money? Is all money just debt instruments and credit transactions and reconciliations? Or are debt and credit just subsets of money? Is money just the government-issued stuff, or is it also money if it can be used in any transaction, even if it's privately issued? Or is it only money if it can be used to pay taxes, fees, and land deed payments to the government? Is it still money if it exists mainly for speculators to bet on its appreciation or depreciation as a bearer asset? Does it matter if money is backed by something or redeemed by something? And if so, what costs and burden does that impose on the monetary system? As I said, Graeber had a lot of thoughts on the philosophy aspect as it meets the practicalities of day-to-day transactions between those redemptions at the bank and later at the government. And he also has a lot of points about the sort of religious vocabulary around a lot of this, which was certainly very popular in the United States, but also present in many other parts of the world. For example, the idea of redeeming paper money for metal is itself, you know, using religious vocabulary and so forth. So those are some questions that I want to put on the table. And Rachel, I'll go to you at this point, since I wrote the narrative for this section and you did a lot of the narrative for the next section. Before we get into that Civil War stuff, what were your thoughts regarding the antebellum money? I know you've commented at several points as we've been preparing this over many weeks that I have forced you to learn a lot more about money, even on a theoretical level, than you ever wanted to.
Yeah, it kind of breaks my brain just that we kind of all decided that these metal coins or these paper bills have meaning, or you can use them to exchange for goods and services. It makes you think about like kind of where the origin of money came from, and it seems like you kind of mentioned earlier, the misty past of human history. So it's hard to think about because it is just so ubiquitous in our daily lives. Like money is everywhere. It's all around us. And it's really interesting because there was this distinction between paper money and metal money, which doesn't exist anymore. Like paper money, and even now the even more virtual money that is like debit cards or credit cards, they have meaning because we give them meaning, and there's nothing backing them. You could buy metal with your money, but it doesn't have to be that way, and we don't have to pay like our tax debts or our government fees in metal money because it has more credibility, more reliability than paper money or virtual ones and zeros on a virtual ledger. It's really interesting to think about. And also, our money is so much more protected today than it was back then. There was no FDIC, so there could be these bank panics, and your money in a bank wasn't guaranteed to retain its value, or it wasn't insured by the federal government. So your money could actually disappear at any time. And it's crazy to think about because there were all these bank panics and runs on the bank's resources. That just doesn't exist today because it is so heavily regulated and protected by the federal government in a way that just didn't happen back then. And it sounds like a lot of people didn't actually want the federal government issuing these kind of decrees about money because limited government was kind of a precious concept back then.
Yeah, and I think that you make an excellent point about sort of the social aspects of all of this. A lot of this really is about a sort of a kind of social contract where people agree to accept and exchange certain things. And there's legal dimensions to it, like you said, right? If you can't exchange some sort of an instrument of account for your tax payments and your land purchases or your customs duties, then is it really money? Well, that's harder to say, but obviously people were using that in other contexts. And of course, as we'll talk about later in the series, things like, you know, the way we use credit cards now, at least not talking about people who are like putting more money on the credit card than they actually have, but just like if you go to the store and you're like, oh, I'm not carrying a 20, I'll swipe my card and then I'll pay back the 20 later. There are antecedents already in this period of that, but people didn't necessarily think of it that way, right? If you say, I don't have 20 on me right now and I need to buy this piece of farm machinery, you would work out an arrangement where you would pay back the farm machinery purchase after your harvest, at least hopefully. But there's a lot of uncertainty here and things like that where sudden sort of demand spikes can happen and then there isn't enough money on hand. And of course, if you have to maintain significant reserves of metal, metal on hand at the bank, then it can't be used for other things. You can't be, you know, using it out in the community to build up a business, generate economic activity, things like that. So there were all these problems. But ultimately, and this is what a lot of the Graeber book actually is about, there is this just fundamentally social component here. And it goes back to the word credit itself, right? You know, this is a credit to someone's name, or this person is of good moral standing, and you know, therefore we can extend a loan. I mean, this goes back, you know, centuries in, you know, in the European culture, which the United States is primarily an offshoot of. And this remains this very kind of fundamental thing, right? As long as you believe that the money, well, I guess it's two parts, right? There is that question of, can you use it for official government payments, right? But other than that, when you're talking about at least within the private sector, as long as you all agree, I can use this thing, whether it's a piece of paper, whether it's a wooden token, whatever it might be, as long as you agree, I can use this to make a transaction in the private sector, right, buy this good or service, and this person's going to accept it, then that is fundamentally money. Similarly, if you don't have that on hand and you just say, and this used to be like a late medieval, early modern tradition in places like England, where, and you see this as the forerunner of the bank clearinghouse process, actually, but at the local sort of individual level, is in places where there's very low circulation of money, everyone says, okay, I'm going to settle up all my accounts with everyone else in the village at the end of the year, right? We're all going to sit around in a circle and say, well, I had to borrow this amount from you, or I had to buy this thing and I didn't have money, and you had to buy this thing from someone else. And you just kind of work through all the math until you figure out what obligations cancel out somebody else's obligations. And then you figure out, okay, at the end of this chain, $5 needs to get paid to such and such company. Usually it's going to be an out of town one, right? Because they're not there. They're not part of these chains of transactions. And so you're going to pull together your money from the harvest time, and you're going to pay off that ultimate bill. But up until that point, everyone is just agreeing, yes, we can use this. Either they're agreeing to do something on, you know, on paper on a ledger, or they're agreeing to exchange paper as a sort of physical ledger system in the meantime. And that works as kind of like an endless game of musical chairs, as long as the music doesn't stop. Now, one thing that I didn't really agree with in the Wayland book is he's coming from a sort of more, you know, anti-deficit, anti-debt type of perspective. And so he's arguing that all of this is fundamentally unsustainable, that the fiat currency stuff that we're about to talk about created all these sort of problems, so on and so forth. And Graeber's argument, interestingly, is that you can set up a perfectly legitimate system of musical chairs where you just never cut off the music and people don't go running for the chairs. As long as the music does continue, which is actually possible in certain contexts, then you don't have a crisis. The problem becomes when you have to, when there is something that is forcing you to convert it to metal currency. So either there's a panic, right, and everyone goes to the bank and tries to cash all of this paper money in circulation in at one time and tries to get their money out. So that's going to cause the music to stop. Or you have a situation where the federal government is requiring that they get their payments in hard, cold cash, right, in physical coinage. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that they had to pay off obligations overseas, and investors overseas were not particularly interested in paper money from the United States during this period. And obviously, it is not necessarily true that every country is in a position to be doing a fiat situation, right? Because if they are dependent on somebody else and they're going to have to convert it to something else later, they are potentially going to run into problems. But in a situation like we have today, where the US is a reserve currency, et cetera, you can get away with just not making those conversions. And again, as long as most of the time the money, this gets to the money multiplier effect that people who are familiar with like basic econ have often heard of, which is that for a while, you're going to get the money just kind of circulating in the community among various people paying various bills. And those aren't necessarily going to cause some sort of a panic or a run either. But I just thought this was a really interesting sort of philosophical thing where we're looking at the situation where it becomes this overriding cultural imperative that paper money is bad because there's no sort of regulation for creditworthiness, trustworthiness, things like that. And so this sort of social compact completely breaks down and people are not willing to accept these things at face value. And we'll also see as we get into the Civil War that a lot of this stuff can kind of fluctuate on how people are feeling about the federal government's chances overall in the Civil War, right? And that's going to lead people one way or another to treat the paper money either better or worse, depending on what point you're looking at. So again, there's a bunch of philosophical questions, which we're not exactly trying to answer here per se, but we're trying to float them and get people to think about them. And that brings us now to part two, which will be the final part of this particular episode. So this is part two, the emergency of the Civil War and the rollback in Reconstruction. The emergency situation of the Civil War, i.e. the need for the federal government to pay for it, ideally without raising taxes or borrowing too heavily from New York and foreign creditors, and the need to keep the economy going, forced the government to consider and then take dramatic action in 1861 and 1862 with the creation of the first nationwide paper money, considered valid for payments to the government for taxes, fees, and land payments that had previously only been accepted in precious metals. Crucially, from 1862 onward, this wartime paper money was indefinitely not guaranteed to be redeemable for precious metals. This was a significant break from any of the previous paper money instruments we've been talking about, which were issued in the antebellum period by private banks. And these paper instruments in the antebellum period had always at least been theoretically redeemable for and backed by precious metal reserves somewhere. Obviously, as we said, you could get into a situation where some note was being traded at a much lower value than its face value, and people were, or the reverse, if people were speculating on it. But in theory, there was a exchange rate to be redeemed for precious metals. One thing, by the way, that I didn't mention earlier is that I think there's interesting parallels to be made, not in a very favorable light, toward the various cryptocurrencies right now, which is that you see this sort of Wild West effect again, where everyone is speculating on these things, but they're not speculating on them as units of account or currency for transactions per se. They're really speculating on them more as an investment vehicle and an appreciating asset. And I think there is something similar there. But again, at the time, you had these paper instruments in the antebellum period that were theoretically supposed to be redeemable for precious metals somewhere. And this was now out the window for this new nationally issued, government-issued paper money from 1862 onward. The wartime emergency greenback paper notes were, therefore, fiat money instead. Whalen notes in his book that private bank notes were functionally regarded by the public as essentially a zero-interest debt instrument where the bearer was owed precious metals, and fiat paper money was a harder concept to understand at the time. This had actually been out of vogue all the way since the Articles of Confederation days, when the Continental Congress paid Revolutionary War troops in paper IOUs, which basically became worthless. And there had been a few kind of exceptions where the federal government had periodically issued interest-bearing paper treasury notes. But again, these were more similar to private bank notes than to the Civil War paper money. The value of greenbacks fluctuated up and down depending on how well the U.S. military was doing during the Civil War. They were also not completely universally accepted because some businesses in certain regions just flat out refused to accept them as payment despite the law requiring them to, and controversially because the federal government continued to require nearly all customs duties to be paid in metal, which I'm assuming was to try to bring in more precious metals from abroad into the country and keep them from flowing out of the country, or at least recoup some of them. So Rachel, I know that you did a lot of research from various books into the emergency measures of the Civil War, the implications of that, and then the transition into the Reconstruction period. So could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So to fund the Civil War, the United States had to greatly increase the money supply. And to do that, President Lincoln, his administration started printing paper money in 1861. And as the administration was printing paper money in 1861, 1862, and beyond, Hoarding of gold coins was becoming a problem, especially as the war dragged on, and it became clear that the paper money would be issued for a long time. People really had a hard time trusting the paper money for the reasons that Bill just described. And so people were holding on to that, their gold coins, their metal currency, just because they knew it was safe and would retain its value. This hoarding was exacerbated by Treasury Secretary Salmon Chase's policy of issuing treasury bonds, or government debt, in exchange for hard money, and this further removed specie from circulation. By the end of 1861, specie payments on debt, both interest and principal, were suspended by private banks, and then eventually even the Treasury stopped collecting specie payments on debt. This caused a panic throughout the country, leading to even more hard money hoarding. In February 1862, the first legal tender acts were enacted, and $150 million in United States notes were printed and were declared legal tender for all debts, public and private, which is a new development in paper money. And a fun fact from the Wikipedia article on United States notes, they were actually issued by the U.S. government up until 1971. So for over 100 years, the government was issuing United States notes. However, the lack of specie to back this paper money caused the value of the greenbacks to plummet and inflation to rise. By 1864, over $400 million in greenbacks were issued. However, the market value of these greenbacks was below half the face value. This was because there was no ability to convert the paper money to hard money equal to the face value of the greenbacks. And this lack of trust in greenbacks led to government intervention in the form of the National Bank Act of 1863 and 1864. An important note, the U.S. Mint issued quote-unquote hard currency for the country from the early constitutional period to present day. When we talk about the lack of a national currency before the Civil War, we are only referring to paper currency, as far as I'm aware, as opposed to minted coins. Depending on the era in question, private banks up until this point issued U.S. legal tender paper money at the state level, these quote-unquote banknotes, but that was basically similar to a bill of exchange, a promissory note, or other paper instruments for financial transactions. So the National Bank Act of 1863 and 1864 were two United States federal banking acts that established a system of national banks and created the United States national banking system. They encouraged development of a national currency backed by bank holdings of U.S. Treasury securities and established the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency as part of the United States Department of the Treasury and a system of nationally chartered banks. The act shaped today's national banking system and its support of a uniform U.S. banking policy. So this National Bank Act helped to finance the Civil War effort. And the bankers also benefited because they were able to collect interest on the government bonds that they held, that government debt, and they could make loans backed by the debt, which effectively allowed them to collect interest twice on their holdings. They were getting interest from the government on the bonds they were holding and also from the loans that they were making to individuals and collecting interest on those loans. So Treasury Secretary Chase's policy of issuing massive numbers of greenbacks caused significant inflation, and he was forced to resign in 1864. From 1861 to 1865, there was a 22% annual increase in inflation. However, after the Civil War ended, the value of the greenback eventually reached parity with gold coins relatively quickly. In 1865, it took $28 in greenbacks to buy a $10 gold piece, but by 1879, they were equivalent. This inflation during the Civil War and right after the Civil War era really helped finance both the Civil War and U.S. expansion westward, especially the railroads were using this inflation to finance their very ambitious projects, expanding westward. After the war, it was assumed that the federal government would contract the paper money supply. However, both the federal government and these large businesses, such as railroads, had incurred massive amounts of debt, and they were really interested in keeping the paper money supply in circulation. If there was a contraction, they would end up owing more of on their debts than if there was an inflation that was reducing the value of their debts over time. Even though many Americans disapproved of paper money as a means of exchange, the expanding post-war economy increased the demand for money in all forms. This rising demand helped to restore the convertibility of paper money for gold at closer to face value of the greenbacks. However, the expansion in the economy was not equally spread across the country. From the Foner book, Reconstruction, the collapse of Confederate bonds and currency bankrupted the entire South, both individuals and institutions such as colleges and churches. The new national banking system drained capital from the South, and there was an onerous federal tax on cotton, which was instituted as a wartime measure and wasn't repealed until 1868. As a result, many commodities in 1865 were exchanged at barter, even in important railroad cities like Chattanooga, Tennessee, from a Charlestonian at the time. The only money here is in the hands of one or two northern exchange brokers and bankers, men entirely unknown to us. So something I noticed from reading the Whalen books, he really didn't talk about the South at all, and that's pretty much exclusively the focus of the Foner book. So between the two, we're kind of covering the entire country at the time. And I would highly recommend reading the Foner book. It is very, very in-depth. It doesn't only talk about money. It talks about every aspect of life from 1863 to 1877. Going back to money, by 1870, there was a serious attempt to eliminate the first nationally issued paper money, ironically by Salmon Chase himself, although this was only a temporary situation. So his post-Treasury Secretary career was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and while he was there, he actually undermined his previous efforts, monetary efforts, from when he was Treasury Secretary. Most notably in the 1870 Supreme Court case Hepburn v. Griswold. So Salmon Chase, acting as Chief Justice, reversed his stance from when he was Treasury Secretary, and he actually declared parts of the Legal Tender Act unconstitutional, which made U.S. notes not legal tender, and U.S. notes could not be used to discharge debts. There was a quote from Whalen. Salmon Chase reportedly disapproved of the legal tender notes in principle. With no requirement for specie backing, they could be printed in unlimited quantities and were therefore inflationary. Chase was also said to have recognized the necessity of issuing paper money in a time of emergency. Later, however, sitting as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, he would declare the notes unconstitutional. However, there were two legal tender cases just the very next year that actually affirmed the constitutionality of paper money. Knox v. Lee and Parker v. Davis effectively overturned the Hepburn v. Griswold ruling. Bill, do you want to read the quote from the Whalen book?
Sure. The Hepburn v. Griswold decision angered the administration of President Ulysses S. Grant, as well as the banks, the railroads, and other heavily indebted corporations, who naturally preferred to settle their obligations in paper rather than gold. When a pair of vacancies came up on the Supreme Court, President Grant nominated two railroad lawyers, William Strong of Pennsylvania and Joseph P. Bradley of New Jersey. In May 1871, a 5-4 majority reversed the court's position from the previous year, and in Knox v. Lee upheld the legality of fiat money and the legal tender laws, largely at the behest of a heavily indebted government and its equally beholden allies among the owners and managers of railroads. The issue of greenbacks was essentially settled in American law.
Ultimately, United States note greenbacks continued to circulate into the 20th century up until the creation of the Federal Reserve and its currency notes, and new ones were actually still being issued on a limited basis over this period. And there's more on that in the show notes, which you will be able to see on the episode show notes. So while we focused mainly on the ownership class and their preferences, greenbackism was also seen favorably by labor. From Foner, greenbackism promised to lower interest rates, thereby facilitating the establishment of cooperatives, a plausible strategy at a time when the scale of enterprise in most industries remains small, promoting economic growth and transferring control of the currency from a parasitical money power to the democratic state. I find it very interesting that worker-owned cooperatives were actually plausible at this time, and it would have been exciting to actually see if it, in a kind of alternate universe, what that would have looked like if these worker-owned cooperatives were allowed to flourish and proliferate. For a while, there was also an effort to stop using silver as a coin in circulation alongside gold, but this too led to political backlash, especially once the price of silver began falling dramatically, and it looked like it could be useful as a cheaper, plentiful, low-denomination coin instead of a previously very expensive one. Until silver supply increased dramatically in the second half of the 19th century with new discoveries and new technologies, silver production had tended to be used for things other than money more often than not. And to give silver coinage advocates a point in their favor, there was indeed a significant shortage of small denomination money in the American West for decades, even into the 20th century, because of the repeated federal attempts to restrict or end circulation of cheap silver coins, because people still didn't trust paper money, which otherwise might have filled that gap in the market. This severely hurt smaller-scale economic transactions on a day-to-day basis, and continued the pressure to engage in in-store credit and other such things, as we'll cover in the next episode.
And we'll also return to this issue of silver coinage and the political battles over that in a upcoming episode as part of the series as well. We don't want to get into the cross of gold stuff yet because we're currently just talking about the immediate Reconstruction period after the Civil War. So Rachel, before we wrap up here, I guess we'll circle back around and have another bit of discussion about this. This was interesting to me that they really hadn't tried to do a national paper money between the Revolutionary War period and its immediate aftermath and the Civil War. There were sort of attempts here and there at it, and there was obviously this kind of like quasi-official money that was in circulation from private institutions and so forth during a lot of the antebellum period. But this does really mark an interesting sea change. So I want to know what your kind of key takeaways were from this section. And again, thinking about some of those questions that I floated earlier on kind of the philosophical and cultural aspects around money.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that this time is what kind of shaped today's national banking system and this uniform currency that is now getting issued by the federal government. Again, it seems like a no-brainer to us because we've kind of been immersed in this sort of banking system our whole lives. So it's really interesting to see a point when today's status quo just didn't exist. And the fact that there was paper money floating around that wasn't worth its face value. That's really hard to think about just because our money today is backed by the government and the face value is its actual value. So it's really interesting to think of a time where things were just so different.
The other thing that I think is important to mention here, which didn't really seem to come up a lot in the books, at least as far as I saw, is that one of the big differences today versus then, I mean, some people are going to disagree with me on this because I know there's some alternative perspectives on, you know, federal debt issuance, treasury bonds, things like that, and so forth. But like, let's go back in time at least to a little bit further before this, the really current era of the last 50 years. And you can see this kind of at the state and local levels more clearly today because of the fact that those are restricted in terms of how much debt they can issue, and often they are required to have balanced budgets. But basically, in the Civil War situation, right, they didn't want to raise taxes. Taxes, you know, they didn't want to, if they could avoid it, they didn't want to impose, you know, an income tax system and so forth, at least for at the beginning. And this was a chronic kind of problem throughout 19th century American history, which is just that the federal government, in a lot of ways, didn't have a lot of money on hand itself, right? They didn't, you know, they could mint the money, certainly, so they had the power to make it, but they had to buy it from the companies that were mining it, right? You had to buy the ore, you had to pay someone to, you know, turn it into money, basically. And you had to then, obviously, have people circulate it back to you. And for a long time, most of the revenues were from those customs duties or from the very, you know, cut rate sale of public lands, especially in the West. And in a situation where you don't have a lot of ways of generating revenue, it's difficult to issue unlimited amounts of whether it is debt or in this case, paper money, because people are going to look at that and say, well, there is no promise that this is going to link back to anything, because how are they supposed to pay this off? They have no source of revenue. And that is a point that I didn't really see brought up in these books. Had there been some sort of a really sophisticated, expansive domestic tax system, they might have been able to have some sort of alternative solution here, but they really had to kind of just go, you know, take that leap off the cliff there. And I think that it worked out for the best, and there were obviously some bumps, but a lot of those bumps were cultural more than they were necessarily economic. And, you know, I don't agree with some of the perspectives in at least one of these books that basically argues that this was some sort of a disaster and a constitutional overreach, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if you had any thoughts about that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. The kind of the contrast from between then and now is we kind of have infinite liquidity. I think, wasn't it Rashida Tlaib that kind of floated the idea of minting a $1 trillion coin? So it's really interesting that we do have cash on hand, but sometimes don't really have the political will to spend it, which is kind of the inverse of how it was then, when there was a will to spend a lot of money, but there just wasn't the cash on hand to do so. So that's an interesting point that you brought up.
Yeah, and I think that, again, there is this aspect to this that is important, which you were alluding to actually in your narrative, which is like the period that we've been talking about, and this is, I guess, why we did these episodes, the period that we've been talking about on this show for the past year and a half is this period that is birthed out of the Civil War and its immediate aftermath, right? This economic takeoff, these boom and bust cycles, these cycles of inflation and deflation and so forth, these depressionary periods and the long depression and things like that, right? And we've done a lot of episodes on this at this point. But what we hadn't talked about so far was how people were financing and paying for all of these things. And certainly some of it was, you know, new sophisticated financial methods for capitalizing these projects. But a lot of it, especially when you look at the consumer economy side, you know, we talked about the rise of marketing and purchasing various goods and canned foods and things like that, and the emergence of clothing that was more than just people having, you know, a work clothes single set and a Sunday clothes single set. This is stuff that we're going to be talking about in more depth, by the way, on the actual like payments side next on our next episode. But this is the birthplace of the economy that we've been talking about for the past year and a half, this Civil War and immediate post-Civil War period. All of these guys emerge out of this changed environment of a huge burst of liquidity, a huge increase in demand by the federal government needing to, you know, pay for certain things. And we talked about things like, oh, you know, they paid to buy, to have the private sector build a lot of factories to produce canned goods for the soldiers and so forth. But what we didn't talk about was how did they actually make those payments? And the answer is they used these new legal tender notes, these United States notes to pay for that. So I thought that it was important that we actually drill down into this and understand that you cannot separate the actual physical and philosophical and theoretical changes in the money in this time period, in the Civil War and its immediate aftermath. You can't separate that from that economic activity, that second industrial revolution explosion that happens right after that.
Yeah, and I think it's valuable to think about these things, even if it is hard to conceptualize something that's so ubiquitous. It's hard to think about money in this kind of philosophical manner just because it's all around us. And to kind of go back to these kind of origins of the U.S. money system, the banking system, is really valuable, because then we can kind of see why we are where we are today and what that came from, which is this post-Civil War era.
All right. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for coming on the show this week to talk about the antebellum, Civil War, and Reconstruction eras of money in the United States.
Thanks for having me.
And as we noted at the beginning of this episode, there were a number of books and podcasts that we referenced extensively throughout this. And as Rachel said earlier in the episode, these will be available at arsenalfordemocracy.com with the show notes. Again, this is an ongoing mini-series that will have several parts, not a huge number of parts, but it does have several parts. And so we'll be returning back to this topic as we continue through this series over the next several weeks. So stay with us for that and check out the upcoming episodes when they're released.